Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We're your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. This weekend show, we're going to be jumping around to a number of different sectors, trying to isolate maybe any opportunities that investors could have in a wide range of sectors that, unfortunately, it seems like pretty much everything is in a bit of a bear market. Energy, though, still continues to be the outperformer, although that's even started to pull back now, really, I think, just being taken with the rest of the markets and how weak everything has been, all with this backdrop of central banks continuing to tighten monetary policy. You take money out of the markets, well, markets seem to fall. We're kicking off this weekend show with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Now, Dana, the real theme, it seems to be, of these markets, again, are bear markets across the board, and commentators trying to find these little relief rallies or counter trend moves. But it really doesn't seem to me like anybody's getting too bullish on the long side. How have you been playing these markets recently, where at least it seems like early on this month, we seem to be getting at least a little bounce in a lot of different sectors?
Yeah, thanks, Corey. I think you hit it on the head. The theme of the past week or two has really been counter trend, whether it's stocks in which, you know, we're in a bear market. At least we would deem it a bear market. The bounce over the last week or so, I think is just a counter trend, another bear market bounce. We don't see any evidence from any of our quantitative indicators or on the charts that this is, you know, more of a sustainable, durable, intermediate term rally or bull market. I think this is more or less a counter trend or mean reversion type of a bounce that we are more apt to be selling into or shorting into. And the same thing goes for some of the other asset classes. You had the monster rally in commodity-related assets, inflation-related assets. That is deflating. That trend is deflating right now. But in the longer term, from a longer-term perspective, I don't think necessarily that long-term uptrend is over. I think this is a counter-trend pullback. I think positioning got a little bit too extended. People got a little bit over-leveraged. Some of the Johnny-come-latelys to the trend got in, started chasing these markets too far, too fast, and the market's always going to punish you for that. So I think this is more or less a counter-trend move there. And same thing with pullback in yields, bond yields. I think that's a counter-trend pullback. I think while there might be more to go on the downside, I think longer term the trend is still higher. So overall, I think the trends, long-term trends, are still in place. On a shorter-term basis, I think the momentum in the near term is with those counter-trend moves until it shakes enough people out. And then once that happens, then we can resume that longer-term trend across the assets.
Yeah, it's an interesting market, Dana, because things that are in a new bear market, like the general equities, they're bouncing. Things that are in a longer-term secular bull market, like the commodities, they're correcting. Things like interest rates that are going up, as you mentioned, and probably will go up for some time if the bond bubble has burst, they're pulling back. So in these kind of counter-trend moves, what kind of actions are you taking? Are you playing it for the short blips, you know, to the upside in the stocks or shorting the commodities, or are you mostly to the sidelines? How are you approaching your portfolio management?
Just trying to be nimble, for one, not get too aggressive in these types of moves. As a manager that has that adopts a lot of trend following type of strategies, you're going to get dinged up a little bit in these types of moves when you're, say, buying the dips in an uptrend and Okay, those that key support level that you thought would be a good dip buying area, that prices just blew right through that. So you're going to get dinged a little bit in those times, but it's better to take your lumps once those areas are broken, blow out of those positions, wait for better positions to or better levels into which to re-enter the markets. So you got to be nimble. And like we talked about last, I think last time, you know, when you have these counter trend moves and this volatility, it's best to wait, and you don't have that type of clarity. Best to wait for, you know, those fat pitches. Don't get too aggressive and too impatient and looking for something to buy. If you are, like we are in the commodity space, for example, you know, we're still longer term bulls. Right now, the counter trend momentum is obviously to the downside. Once some of those initial key support levels and many of those commodity markets were broken, then it became clear, okay, there's more momentum to the downside in this counter trend move than we thought there might be. So best to wait for more substantial support levels lower, be more patient for more of a fat pitch than you would be before, when every small dip was being bought and immediately rallying. So better be patient, wait for better, like I said, better pitches, fatter pitches to hit than being hyper aggressive in this type of environment. But being nimble, taking some surgical strikes here and there, while also being overall very defensive right now, I think is the best strategy to take in a market like this. Right now, for example, our model has about 50% in cash. So we've got a ton of cash waiting, you know, for the right opportunity. This is the most cash we've had probably in years after having a very opportunistic market for a couple of years. Got a lot of cash right now waiting to deploy, but trying to be patient in waiting for those opportunities to deploy it.
So cash continues to be really critical for investors because of the fact that it sounds like we might still see some broadly lower prices, but bounces along the way. Let's get into the commodities, starting off with energy, because energy really was the standout commodity, I think, recently, especially the oil price. That made a run up close to, I think, a little over 120, back down to about 100 now. The stocks, that's also been beneficial, where the stocks joined in on that rally and really went higher. They skyrocketed higher, have shown some weakness recently. What's your outlook for the energy sector, more specifically oil?
Yeah, generally the same as the comments I made in commodities in general. You know, I think longer term, we're still in a bull market in the commodity space, including oil and including energy stocks. In the short term, we're in a pretty sharp, pretty violent type of a counter trend pullback. So I think, like I said, investor positioning got a little bit too skewed to the long side. So some of those late comers are being punished right now. I think the momentum in the near term is still to the downside. So right now, while longer term, we're still bulls in the space, I think that we'll see in the short term, I think we'll see lower prices below those recent lows of the last few days before we see potentially an ultimate bottom put in place for this counter trend pullback. But once that occurs, again, I think there's more upside to come in the long-term bull market there.
Dana, let's also talk about the precious metals. A lot of our audience is keen to talk about gold, silver, and the mining stocks. How are you seeing those set up? You had mentioned off mic that you thought silver actually was closer to a bottom than gold. That's an interesting take. Just love you to break that down for our audience.
Sure. Just on a technical basis, looking at, we trade for our clients all ETFs. So looking at the SLV, got very close recently, the last few days, to a key spot where we're looking to add a little bit more exposure to that. We've got a small position there, looking to add a little bit more exposure there to the SLV, which tracks silver around that 1740 level. So not too far away from that. Whether it holds there or not, we're not sure, obviously, but from a risk-reward standpoint, I think it's a good spot to start adding a little bit back there. As far as gold and specifically the GLD, I think it's got a little bit further downside to go before attractive risk reward buying levels for us, which right now would be down around that 158-ish level in GLD, down from trading around 162, 163, I think, right now. So being patient a little bit further for a little bit further downside there in that market before adding further exposure there. But again, I think this is, there's no evidence being flashed to us yet that this is, you know, that the bull market is over for gold or silver or the precious metals in general. So I think once we do put in a nice intermediate term bottom, it might actually end up being a longer term bottom. You might eventually see that next leg up in that long term bull market. And that would mean, you know, new highs breaking in gold, for example, breaking those highs that we saw this year in 2020 and similar highs that we saw, you know, a decade ago.
Well, that would sure be encouraging. Now, do the gold stocks or the miners follow along? Because they have, unfortunately, generally been weak, even when gold ran to some of those all-time highs recently. The mining stocks, if you're looking at GDX, it was still well off of their all-time highs of back in about that 2011 time frame. How do you see GDX playing out?
Sure. You know, the miners have, you know, had a couple headwinds facing them, very recently, including obviously the pullback in the precious metals prices, gold and silver, the commodities themselves. But, you know, they've had the headwind all year of an equity bear market. So, you know, while they are heavily tied to, you know, resource prices, they are still equities, which in a bear market, an overall bear market, that is going to put downward pressure on them, no matter what subsector they're in. So that has been a challenge for them. But we do see, like gold and silver, we do think a new up leg to that longer term bull market is on its way. They did, the miners themselves or the ETFs did break some key support levels about a week ago, which had us basically stopping out of the rest of our miners exposure for now, opened up further downside before we thought there might be a better opportunity to get back in. So on something like GDX, for example, we're looking down after breaking that, you know, around that 29-ish level, that opened up further downside down towards about 25.40 or so. So we're looking around that 25-ish range to start adding some exposure back to GDX. But right now, I think too much risk here in the short term to be to start getting back in.
Well, Dana, one other one we should probably cover in the commodity space is the base metals, and probably the king of the base metals is copper. I think you follow copper pretty closely. Some people are saying they think it's getting ready to bounce, but I'm not sure if you're sold on that idea. So just share with us your outlook on the red metal.
Yeah, copper's in a lot of the in the same camp, you know, as a lot of the commodities that had a huge run. And like I mentioned to you guys before, that markets that have huge moves one way are going to be subject to sharp and potentially painful mean reversion moves. So that's what we're seeing right now. Right now, I think in the long term, I think this pullback's still a counter trend move. In the long term, the uptrend is still in place. However, in the short term, the momentum is such that it would not surprise me. In fact, it would lower lows would not surprise me. It would surprise me if we didn't see lower lows here coming up at some point in the near term in copper, in commodities in general, before a sustainable low is put in place and we can start rallying again. Again, this move has happened so fast that I think a lot of investors that, like I mentioned before, were late to the commodity rally, only started buying in when inflation started hitting the headlines and became the story, the thesis became mainstream. So they started piling into the commodities way late into the rally. And I think a lot of that has to still be wrung out before we have a decent sustainable low in place. And I think that's going to be, it's going to require a little bit more of a process of selling and testing lower lows before that bottom is in place.
All right, Dana, how about tech? Because, look, tech really out of the broad averages has sold off the most. The NASDAQ from peak to recent bottom, almost 35% down. It's rebounded about 5.5% so far just this month. But again, seems very much still like a bear market rally, dead cat bounce. Do you see any opportunity in tech? Because it was a leader. It led now to the downside. Maybe on bounces, it could lead a bit more to the upside.
Sure. You know, in long term, no, I don't. We still don't like tech because it did go so far to the upside. I think there's more pain to come. And we are secular stock market bears. I think there's a lot more pain to come over the next maybe couple of years. But tech, following along with basically the inverse of the commentary on commodities, you know, tech has gotten hit the hardest, sold off the most. Areas like the internet, or you look at take the ARK Innovation Fund, for example, that just got obliterated. The more violent the move to the downside, the more violent the mean reversion bounces will be. So any dead cat bounce, bear market bounce, mean reversion bounce, you're going to see tech and growth try to lead the way. And those does not mean that the bear market is over. It doesn't mean that the long-term downtrend is over. But during these counter trend bounces, you might see, you know, some outperformance in some of those spaces that have gotten hit so hard just because they've gotten hit so hard. So there is some action on the charts that has enticed us to put on, you know, a couple trades on the long side, just because there might be a little bit more juice in the tech space, in the growth space, in some of these counter trend bounces. But from a longer term perspective, unless you're super nimble, super active, I would continue to stay away from that area of the market, the NASDAQ tech growth space, and continue to sell or even hedge your portfolio into bounces, into resistance there.
Well, Dana, that was kind of my next logical point, was if you think that this is a relief rally in the general markets and in sectors like tech, and there's a lot of other ones in the general markets that are bouncing right now that had been punished for the last 6 to 8 months, would you start reshorting those at a certain point if they hit a certain resistance level? And what level would you be looking at if you were going to short some of them again as a hedge?
Sure, absolutely, we would. And we are, you know, our portfolio is pretty hedged, pretty defensive right now. And now that you mentioned the NASDAQ, you know, this counter trend move, this bounce in the NASDAQ 100 has pretty much brought it right to a spot where we'd be looking to sell, especially if you're long and you're looking for, okay, I need a bounce to get out of it. Right now, I would take that opportunity to get out of that. If it keeps going, so be it. But there's, at this point in the short term, I think there's a lot more downside now, despite how bad we've gotten beat up all year. I think in the near term, there's more downside right now in the short term after this bounce that we've had than there is upside, at least from a risk-reward standpoint. So this is one spot. Or if you're looking, if you're substantially long, you're looking for a spot to put on a hedge, this isn't a bad spot in the NASDAQ to add a little bit of hedge to your portfolio in case, you know, we do get another down move here in the short term, which would not surprise me. So NASDAQ 100 right now is trading around, call it 12,175, is around that resistance spot I'm talking about. It's got downside to us down near about 10,600. So that would be a pretty painful move to sit through. So I would be, we would be sellers right at this time.
All right, Dana, we'll wrap it up here. Always interesting comments. And I always find it fascinating just how you are reading these markets. Big theme being we're still, it seems like, in bear markets with odd little relief rallies here and there, and bear markets. Well, this one's already lasted pretty long, and we still haven't even had kind of that capitulation event. Who knows if we'll even get that, but this theme of lower prices and bear market rallies, any rallies really not being believed, seems to continue now in the second half of the year. Dana, thanks for your time. As always, buddy, great chatting with you. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. We'll chat in another couple weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am replaying an interview that we posted on Friday, focused on energy with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. I decided to replay this one because there's a lot of good information in here from Dan regarding stocks he likes and regarding some of the more macro makeup for the energy sector. That, again, is why I'm replaying this, so I hope you all enjoy it. And in case you missed it on Friday, here's another chance to hear what Dan has to say. Hey, everyone. Welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're focused on the energy sectors. We are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, it's been a while since we had Dan last on the show. Actually, it took me a little while to get Dan locked into a time slot, but I'm glad we did because, look, Dan, really the energy sector has been the outperformer this year broadly in almost any market. And that even is with this pullback that we've had in crude, in the energy sector broadly. But first things first, we keep on hearing about some of these bullish arguments saying that, look, the supply-demand imbalance is still in favor of the bulls. Especially when you consider, when you look at OPEC, and there it seems like unwillingness to increase production, or maybe it is just the fact that they can't increase production that much. The U.S., everyone's waiting for that country to ramp up production. Dan, let's start off simply. Supply and demand, even after this pullback in oil, do you think that, especially when it comes to oil, there is going to continue to be this real supply deficit?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that OPEC countries could just go out and turn on some valves and increase their production. Well, I want to make it perfectly clear. They are totally tapped out. They keep having these monthly meetings and they raise their official quotas, but they have not produced up to their quota for like 8 months in a row. And I think not for June, but for May, their production was over 2 million barrels a day below their quota. And the reason why is some of these smaller countries in OPEC, they have not kept up development of their own fields. They were underinvesting in their own fields. And so two-thirds of the countries are really on decline. And now you've got Saudi Arabia, UAE, maybe got a little bit of upside, but not without spending a lot of money. They really, I don't know if you saw it on your media up there when the French prime minister or something cornered Biden and said, hey, look, I met with Saudi Arabia and they've only got like 150,000 barrels a day of additional production, which compares to a world that that needs about 100 million barrels a day of oil-based products. So there's nowhere else to turn. And, you know, I look at some of these reports that come out of the International Energy Agency based in Paris, and they're overestimating what I think the U.S. oil companies are going to be able to bring. We have only in the United States, we have only increased our production about 200,000 barrels a day since last November. Production always kind of does go down in the first quarter because of weather related issues, but we're just very slowly coming back. And they expected U.S. oil production to bounce back to pre-COVID levels like real quickly. And I just don't see it happening. And then you got the pressure from Wall Street to live within cash flow and return dividends to your shareholders. And I think it's smart. That's what they're doing. And, you know, you got a government down here that's like at war with the oil and gas industry. So these companies, they're focusing on paying off their debt. The balance sheets are in great shape. And but from a macro standpoint, this is a very, very tight global oil market today.
Well, Dan, it's also interesting, especially, you know, just focused on where is the growth going to come from. And when they're saying, oh, look at the U.S., they could really ramp up. We were talking off mic before we started recording. the disconnect between what politicians are saying or even what some of the mainstream media is saying. Like, look at these big greedy oil companies making all this money and charging these high prices. First of all, they're not setting the prices. They benefit from higher prices, but there's a decade or more of underinvestment in oil and gas companies because they were punished by everybody, not just the recent ESG trend, but for a decade, banks have been told, hey, quit lending to them, reduce your exposure. In the markets, the general makeup of the general markets, there's such a smaller percentage that's actually focused on oil and gas and the big funds and ETFs. And then a lot of people, just for moral reasons, they thought they had the high ground. Let's shun these oil and gas companies. And now the prices are high. They want everybody to just flick the switch, like you said, and start drilling baby drill and pump baby pump. And it's not that simple. So maybe speak to that macro part of the company side of things.
Well, for one thing, in the early part of the shale revolution or whatever you want to call it, you know, 5 years ago, they had to go out and get large blocks of acreage because these horizontal wells, you know, they have 2 mile long laterals. So you don't need just a 40 acre thing. You need a 1200 acre block of acreage to drill these long laterals. So they were spending a lot of money, overspending maybe on the acreage cost. So all this rumor that the shale companies can't make any money. Well, now most of that acreage is held by production, so they don't have a gun to their head to drill these wells. Because once you establish production on a leased block of acreage, you hold that lease forever as long as you keep producing. So it may have had an original like 3 to 5 year term on that lease, but once you start producing oil and gas, it's held by production, HBP. And so now they don't have, we call it the lease, you know, the land requirements or something to drill more wells just to hold your acreage. So they don't have to. And then they're just under pressure. I mean, they had to pay off a bunch of debt. They don't trust the lenders to be there if they need them. So these companies, and I follow like 30 upstream companies, and their number one priority is paying off debt. And they believe their stock is grossly undervalued. So probably number two is share buyback programs. And then the bigger ones that are already almost debt-free, they're paying very good dividends. So there's a lot of opportunity out here. And I tell you, these companies are not trading as if oil is near $100. They're trading as if oil is like $60.
We'll get into a few more of the stocks, but I do want to ask you about a potential war premium that is still within the oil price, or that also could be playing into this supply deficit, strictly because, look, the war is still ongoing. It seems to have less of a market impact right now, but we do continue to hear about different potential sanctions and the issues that Europe is having getting the necessary oil and energy that they need. How much do you think this ongoing war in Ukraine is still playing into this picture?
Well, it's not as much as it was, because if you look at a price chart, there was a big like $25-$30 jump in the price of oil right when Russia invaded Ukraine. But I will remind you, if you go pull like a 1 year chart of WTI or Brent, WTI was already at $90. It was at $90 before the war started. So maybe there's a $10 premium still in there. But then, you know, all these sanctions immediately come in, but the oil was still flowing for quite a while. And now you got China and India that are still willing to buy the oil. Now, just for logistic reasons, you know, the oil that you were pumping to Europe, that you now have to turn and pump it all the way across, you know, Russia. Russia is putting less oil on the market. You know, they're still talking about more additional sanctions and stuff like that. But I think Putin got the upper hand. He could shut off all oil and gas going to Eastern Europe. And man, that would be devastating to the European economy. I think one of the biggest risks is that we have Europe's economy almost fall off a cliff if they don't have enough energy to make it through the winter. But I did see it today on this situation, is that a big pipeline coming out of Russia to the Black Sea may be forced to shut down for 30 days. I just saw that coming across the wire before we got on this call.
Yeah, it's interesting, kind of the pipeline wars, because we saw the Keystone pipeline killed here. There was that Nord Stream 2 that was very controversial. They were going to shut that down. And so some of it's not just on the producer side of thing. It's how do you get the oil to the different ports and how do you get it out? And I guess another area to cover, Dan, I'd love to get your thoughts on it, is the pinch points when you see a high price of gasoline or diesel, they're not necessarily the blame is keeps being put on the producing companies. It's a lot of times the refining and processing where the pinch points are. So could you maybe speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, the refiners, the crack spread, the profit they're making on these refined products is pretty darn high. Now, the situation with diesel, and our diesel inventories are like 20% below where they should be, is because we don't have enough heavy oil. The oil coming out of our shale plays is light oil, or even ultra light oil, 40 above 40 gravity. The higher the gravity, the lighter oil. In fact, actually, some of that oil coming out of shale wells is actually clear. You could put it in your car for a while as gasoline, but not for long because it'd be super high octane. But anyway, we needed the Keystone Pipeline because we need heavy oil from Canada. And then also when we were cut off from Venezuelan oil supply, that's also heavy oil that our Gulf Coast refineries were built for. So we have a shortage of heavy oil. And then we were getting some heavy oil from Russia. And we were also importing about 7 or 8% of our diesel, refined product diesel, was coming from Russia. So there is a shortage of diesel fuel. And if we would have a hurricane hit the Gulf Coast refineries and shut some of them down for a while, I got to believe we would have diesel rationing. And, we're not going to be able to solve these supply chain problems without our trucking fleet running at full speed. And, you know, trucks are not Teslas. They run on diesel. And we need that. And also, all the oil field rigs and stuff run on diesel also, all that heavy equipment. So it's a really big deal and probably something that we don't focus on enough. And it's, high diesel prices are what is probably contributing more to inflation than high gasoline prices, because that's what the truckers have to pay. I saw an article the other day, some of these truckers, when they go to fill up their, they have 250-gallon tanks, they may be several thousand dollars to fill up a truck when they stop. And those costs have to be passed on to consumers. So it's a really big deal.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of costs passed on to consumers. Hey, that is just another example of it. Let's get into some of the stocks, because reading over your material, I really like how you have segregated your stocks into different types of portfolios. We're going to start with one of the more interesting to me, and that is the high yield dividend portfolio. So these are stocks that I believe you isolate that pay right around 10 or greater percent. There's a lot of stocks, it seems like, that are paying some pretty high dividend yields, especially after the fact that their stocks have even gone up pretty well. Take us through how you're viewing the overall health of, first of all, these dividend paying stocks.
Yeah, for one thing, their balance sheets are in outstanding shape. And that's why I put them. So when I pick a company for our high yield income portfolio, it is number one, is their dividend sustainable? That's number one. And number two, I'm looking for companies that I believe are going to be able to raise dividends. And probably 2/3 of the companies in the portfolio, I think we have 13 now. Anyway, 2/3 of them, I believe, will be raising their dividends in the next couple of quarters. The upstream companies I've moved in there, the largest one is Pioneer Natural Resources. And I was on an interview with the CEO of that company, and he said they're raising their dividend and it will be a 15% annualized yield. And Pioneer is virtually debt-free. It's a, $30, $40 billion market cap company, super strong balance sheet, lots of running room. And they can maintain, their business plan is to have 5% annualized production growth year over year. And they can do that on a modest budget and still generate a lot of free cash flow that can pay dividends, buy back shares. They've already paid down their debt as much as they really need to. So that's probably the safest one on the list. The symbol is PXD. And I've also moved Devon Energy in there. That's DVN, Diamondback Energy, FANG. You can remember, that's an easy one to remember the symbol. If you look at Diamondback Energy, that's a true American success story. 5 or 6 years ago, nobody heard about that company. And now it is one of the best Permian Basin companies. And another one, now this one is more of a natural gas play. It's Coterra Energy. And it was created by the merger of Cimarex into Cabot Oil and Gas. And then right after the merger, they changed the name of the company. But both of those companies have been around for decades, and a very, very solid management team on that one. And based on their last dividend, which is, it was 12.5% dividend yield. And now that the stock's pulled back a little bit, it's probably more like 15%. So all of those four companies should be paying out dividend, have dividend yield over 10% based on their current share. Now, I will tell your listeners, if you go look it up on Yahoo Finance or something, they have a dividend that's called a fixed plus variable dividend. And sometimes you look at the yield and the only thing shown on Yahoo or, you know, E-Trade or whatever may just be the fixed dividend. But those variable dividends are very much locked in because they have such high cash flow.
Well, Dan, it sounds like the strength of the larger companies is there because A, they're paying down the debt, they're paying these dividends, they're buying back shares. Seems like the health of the industry is maybe as good as it's been in a long time. But what about the smaller companies, maybe the smaller producers or the up-and-coming developers? What's your outlook on those companies and any that stick out to you?
Yeah, and we do have some small companies in the high yield income portfolio that also have probably like 50% upside on them. But we have two other growth companies, and half of these companies also pay a dividend too. But they're more for growth. And that portfolio is trading for probably today about 150% below my current valuation for the portfolio. And I'm only valuing these companies at, you know, 5 to 8 times operating cash flow. And, you know, if you have a profitable company with a strong balance sheet and they have lots of running room, they have lots of low risk, high return drilling inventory, they should be trading for 8 to 10 times operating cash flow. The problem that we still are fighting with is just lack of confidence in the sector. I mean, you have some people still believing we're all going to be driving electric vehicles in the next couple of years, and we're not going to need oil and gas. Well, I can tell you, this year in Europe was a rude awakening of how much this world still depends on, you know, hydrocarbon based fuels, and that's not going to change. So, you know, I'm really looking at growth and some of the smaller companies because they've been able to make some acquisitions and are going to, you know, have some. What I've seen recently is these public companies are able to buy out some of these private drilling companies, because what will happen in these private drilling companies, a lot of them are partnerships, and they'll go out and raise $50 to $100 million. They'll drill a bunch of wells, but they can't keep going back tapping. They can't keep going back asking their partners for more money. So their end game strategy is a lot of times just sell off the whole partnership. And so these partnerships add a bunch of undrilled locations. They have solid production and they're being picked up. One that was just announced a closing yesterday was Silver Bow Resources. And I really like this company. My valuation is like $90 on it. I think it's trading for under 35 now. The symbol is SBOW, and it's got a real balanced production mix. They have a big gas discovery out in the western part of the Eagleford, out in Webb County. And it's for the size of this company, it's a really big deal. But they just closed two acquisitions that are going to significantly raise their production this quarter. And it's got real strong cash flow. So Silver Bow, one you can look at. We also have four what I would call gassers that get the majority of their revenue from natural gas. And even though natural gas is pulled, I know it spiked to like 9 and it's now below 6. But if you'd have told these companies at the beginning of the year that they could lock in $5 gas for the next couple of years, they would have just loved you and done it. But, you know, we got gas prices now up. Antero Resources, that's AR, Comstock, CRK. That company is controlled by Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. Then the largest natural gas producing company in the United States, in North America, is EQT Corp, and the symbol is EQT. They produce about 5 billion cubic feet of gas per day and a whole bunch of natural gas liquids that are high value. And then Range Resources, RRC. even big, I mean, EOG has pulled, EOG Resources, which is about an $80 billion market cap, super strong balance sheet with tens of thousands of drilling locations and inventory. And it's trading at about a 60% discount to my breakup value for that company. So that's one to take a look at.
So a lot of these names that you've shared with us here, I've been searching through the symbols. I follow along with a couple of them. A lot of these stocks have gone up some more than even 10 times in the last about 2 years. Do you think they've gotten a little overheated though, Dan, especially when you consider the macro environment of investors really not being that aggressive with their funds?
Well, so two little Canadians that I love, which were, you know, people thought they weren't going to make it, but they struggled through. They're probably up 500-800% since 2 years ago. And that's Hemisphere Energy. I know you may have had them on your show, and Doug Bartoli's In Play Oil Company. I think from today, if you say oil is going to hold in the $90 to $100 range, I think both of those companies should be triples. They have paid off so much debt. They're in great shape. Hemisphere is definitely going to be debt free, or can be. I don't know if they'll start paying off bigger dividends or something, but they can easily be debt free by the end of this quarter, by the end of September. I think by the end of the year, In Play could be totally debt free, but I don't think they will be. They got a very low, very attractive interest rate on a loan that's backed by the Canadian government. And I don't see any reason they should pay that off. But they have got hundreds of high rate of return drilling inventories in some acres that they've been acquiring over the last couple of years. So it's got tremendous upside. One that's a Canadian-based company, used to be called Encana, is Ovintiv. And it looks very good to me. And that's it's a large company. It's like 500,000 BOE per day company, and they pay a nice dividend. And it's from where it's trading now, it looks really, really attractive.
Well, Dan, just one other area to touch on in this energy sector would be the oil services companies, whether they're pipeline companies, drilling companies, refining companies, any other maybe in that area that stand out to you.
Well, I don't really cover the oil. I used to cover a lot of the drillers, and I would say that the drilling rates, the rig rates are going up. They have more pricing now. And the thing is, when you start talking about these shale wells that go down a mile and a half, 9,000-10,000 feet, and then they go sideways for 2 miles or so, that requires a very large rig with high horsepower, very sophisticated rigs, and those rigs are all working. They're all back working. So there's kind of a shortage rig. You're not going to get any drilling company just going out and, you know, like building new rigs until they have long-term contracts on those rigs. So that's getting tight. So the rig rates are going up. And so I like Helmerich & Payne. Their symbol is HP, Patterson, PTN, and Neighbors, NBR, are all high quality drilling companies. There's some others, but I don't really follow that sector. There's one of our small caps that I really like. And again, this company made it through the pandemic because they were debt free before the pandemic hit. So a lot of their competitors fell by the wayside when completion activity dropped. And it's Solaris Oilfield Infrastructure. Its symbol is SOI, and it is a very unique company that provides equipment and software products to manage frac sand at the drilling location. So what happens is these companies, they'll go to a pad and they may drill 4, 6, 8 wells from a single location. They call it a pad, but it's, you know, the size of a football field, and they drill, you know, 8 wells, let's say, and then they bring in all the completion equipment, and it's a several million dollar project to complete a well. And Solaris's equipment, it stores sand vertically as opposed to horizontally. And if you go to their website, they have videos that shows you how it works, but they have gained a considerable amount of market share. And as drilling activity picks up, and really as well completion activity has picked up, their revenues are just going up quarter after quarter. And they pay a nice little dividend already, about a 42 cents a year. And so if their stock is like $10, yeah, so you're talking about a 4 or 5% dividend yield now. And again, they're debt free. So as their cash flow goes up, I believe they will increase their dividends. And they continued paying dividends all the way through the pandemic. So they're very committed to that. It's one of their business strategies. So that's one I would, a little niche playing company that I would look at. And I think very low risk just because they've got all their equipment's working. And I don't see any reason why they're going to stop completing wells anytime soon.
All right, Dan, we'll wrap it up here. You've given us a lot of stocks to look into and still a lot of optimism around this energy sector, especially when you consider if OPEC is unable to raise production or even unwilling, and if the U.S. can't ramp up their production, we could stay in this generally higher oil price environment for a while. And these are companies that actually return money to shareholders in a timely fashion. So attractive on many fronts there. We'll have you back on hopefully next month there, Dan, to continue hearing your thoughts on the energy sector and the stocks that you like. If anybody has any questions for Dan, please feel free to email us at any time. I'll post our email addresses in the posting. And hey, as I mentioned, we'll follow up with Dan. We'll also follow up with some of these companies that Dan has mentioned. Dan, thank you again for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to shift our focus a little bit for the remainder of this show as we are chatting with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a lot of well-known investors in the resource space. Now, Jayant, we're not going to belabor the point that the precious metal stocks and commodity stocks pretty much across the board are just getting hammered. We're going to follow up on a conversation we had about a month ago, featured again on a weekend show. We were talking about jurisdictions. We went through a number of jurisdictions, mostly focused in North America and bleeding a little bit into Mexico. That took up our whole time. So now we're going to shift our focus, continuing south in now South America, more Latin America. We have received a number of emails asking for some more thoughts on Australia, but we're working through that. In all fairness, we just don't isolate different areas in Australia all that much, but maybe we should. Let's get to Latin America, and let's start with Chile, because the recent news out of Chile regarding Rio 2, that essentially is having their project, I guess, shut down, or at least pretty heavily on pause here. This is putting a bit of hesitancy in investors even looking at projects in Chile, especially advanced projects. Now, Jayant, just outside of that Rio 2 news, how are you viewing Chile as a jurisdiction currently?
Well, so let me start with saying something politically incorrect, Corey. From whatever I have read, watched of Pinochet, I have always thought that he was someone who did a lot of good to Chile. He made it possible for Chile to become one of the best countries in Latin America. Now, he was, of course, a dictator. He killed a lot of people. But given the alternatives that Chile had at that point of time, it seems to me that he was actually a good person, a decent person to have for what else was available. Now, he left in place a capitalist constitution for Chile, and that constitution is likely on its way out, which means that private property is not going to be as respected as it is now. And Chile will continue to lose its prominence as a destination for investors. I know several people who had moved to Chile about 10 years back, Canadians and American friends of mine who moved to Chile to live in Chile. And they are all back to North America today because they have started to realize that the bad elements in the society are starting to assert their power in that society. So that is, in my view, a big problem for Chile. It is no longer going to be a prime place to invest for investors, given that the current president is a leftist and the constitution is very likely to get seriously compromised over the next couple of years.
Yeah, Giant, it's kind of a mess. And what's interesting about Chile is it used to be, on the Fraser Institute, one of the best jurisdictions to operate in. But in February of this year, I mean, just in 2022, the Chile Assembly debated nationalizing their copper mines. And we've got some of the biggest copper mines on the planet operating in Chile. It's one of the number one countries for copper mining, BHP, Anglo American, Glencore, Antofagasta, big companies. And then just in July, they decided to change the taxes on copper mining and reform that system and the royalties. So it's one of those things where if they want foreign investment, they're doing a lot of things to crush any interest in foreign investment. And Peru is right on their tail. And we're seeing the same thing in Colombia and Ecuador. So when you look at Latin America, in particular South America, all of these leftist governments are now going towards leaning towards nationalization, leaning towards higher taxation, and there's a lot of local groups and organized groups pushing back on new mines and permits. So what do you think of this trend we're seeing in Latin America?
Well, and this trend, Shad, will continue. Remember that America historically has been a force behind stopping degeneration of Latin America into leftism. Now America itself is becoming woke and leftist. So America no longer has either the intention or an interest to stop the slide of Latin America towards leftism and wokeism. And the end result will be that I cannot see how this degeneration towards leftism and wokeism in Latin America can be stopped right now.
That doesn't sound very positive for resource stocks or for investors looking for opportunities in Latin America. That sounds like money could pretty quickly dry up for a lot of these companies.
Not necessarily, Corey, because you always invest from the point of view of whether you can get a return from your investment. What you are going to do going forward is to pay less for those properties. And when you pay less for those properties, your profitability will be lower, but you will have paid much lower for those properties anyway. And that is how you invest in many of these countries in let's say, sub-Saharan Africa. So you just pay a lot lower price for those properties. Now, the local people and the government think that by being more difficult, they can extract more value from investors. But quite in contrast, what they end up doing is that they end up destroying values of the projects in their countries. But what can we do? We are offered lemon. We better make lemonade from it.
That's true, Giant. Sometimes you can make lemonade out of the lemons. And to your point, you know, a lot of times, the West African companies trade at a huge discount to, let's say, North American companies, but a lot of their projects are moving forward. The trend I'm seeing personally when I look across the board in Latin America is their projects are not moving forward. They're not getting the mines built. And if a company comes in and spends $50 million, $100 million, several hundred million dollars, and then gets their project blocked, it doesn't encourage new investment to come in. But we noted one thing off mic before we started recording that's interesting. The countries that were considered kind of the worst countries in Latin America, like your Argentinas or Brazils, don't look as bad as they once did. In fact, some of them have slight improvements in compared to the countries that were the favored countries kind of falling. So is there just that teeter-totter where some countries are at their max optimism and they're going to naturally fall and some are at their max pessimism and they can actually only go up from where they're at?
Well, Shad, I was talking with a company with a gold project in Brazil, and they were telling me that their profitability actually has improved with time because Brazilian currency has fallen a lot. Also, I completely agree with you that Argentina and Brazil, which did not look like good places to invest in, have, compared to other Latin American countries, started to look good. That is not necessarily because Argentina and Brazil have improved their profiles, but it's because these countries haven't really worsened much with time. Although I might add that I'm hearing that Bolsonaro might be on his way out in the next election. And if that happens, then Brazil could go very rapidly leftist again.
So the trend sounds like it's in the wrong direction. What about Colombia and their recent election? We've seen a lot of stocks that have been in Colombia. In all fairness, it seems like it's been very difficult to get really much work done on Colombian projects. But now with Petro elected, seems like the attitude's even worse in Colombia.
Yes, and that could harm, I think, the early stage companies more than the mining companies themselves. At the end of the day, these leftist, communist, socialist dictators, they still want tax money. So if a company is producing and giving them taxes, they might let these companies continue to run. But moreover, there's always, these are the communist leaders are not necessarily communists. They are always in bed with bad elements in the societies, and things continue to work the way they used to. And these communist dictators are usually not very skilled at imposing communism. They don't really understand how their society works, how the institutions work. So they are not in a position often to impose an immediate harm on companies that are actually producing, who are producing something right now. So I am less concerned about mining companies in Colombia, but I'm certainly more concerned about early stage companies in Colombia.
Well, Giant, what about a country like Ecuador, which had a terrible reputation, let's say 10 years ago, because they had reversed all of their mining codes, the same things we're seeing in Chile and Peru and Colombia right now. They had done all the wrong things, discouraged investment, but then they flipped the script and they turned into suggesting they were pro-mining and it was going to be a new government and new pro-mining stances. And that went well for a couple years, but the last couple years, it's kind of fallen on deaf ears. A lot of their projects have gotten stalled, blocked permits, and not just by the government. But in this particular question, how important is the social license? Because it's local organized groups, sometimes very well-funded lobbyist groups, that are blocking these mines and causing a stir. There's riots going on and protests all over Ecuador right now. How important is for companies to get a handle on the social license?
Well, that is what exactly the problem seems to be in Ecuador, because the government seems to be in favor of mining companies going ahead, but many local tribes don't want that to happen. And that's where companies come in conflict with the locals, and locals don't allow these projects to get off the ground. But again, I am invested in a couple of companies in Ecuador. I think they are cheap enough that the risks have been discounted in the share prices of those companies. So I'm not worried too much about Ecuador right now, but always remember that Ecuador has historically been a leftist country. It has historically been a very backward country, and there's no way out for that society. It is going to continue to become a leftist country. But as an investor, I am only looking for the next 5 to 10 years.
So, Giant, what do you look for in some of these countries, like especially Peru, where it seems like it can take forever to get drill permits, Ecuador, Colombia? They all seem to be going in the wrong direction. But if you're looking for investments over the next 5 to 10 years, what's critical in your eyes in terms of what companies have, whether it be permits, money, projects? What do you look for?
Well, so let's talk about, I'm not going to name that company in Colombia, but this company is a producing company, and the management are not the best management in the sector, but then they are in a position to twist the arms of political leaders to get their work done. They are in a position that politicians cannot really trouble this management too much. As a result, I feel better about that management, despite that I don't like the personalities in that management. The second thing I like is that how much tax they are paying. If they are paying a substantial amount of tax, it is very important for any kind of, whether it's leftist or conservative government, to continue to let those companies work because they are getting a lot of tax money from those companies. Now, early stage companies don't benefit the government in terms of taxes. So they are the companies that can easily suffer. But my guess is that mining companies that are actually giving a good amount of taxes to the government should be all right.
Well, Giant, just along that line of thinking and sticking with the Latin American theme, when you go into Central America, most countries are completely uninvestable. If you're looking at Panama or El Salvador or Belize, you know, Costa Rica, nobody really wants to operate there. But there are two Central American countries, part of Latin American mining, and that's Guatemala and Nicaragua. And it seems like the tale of two countries, and one is, and it's really around this theme of taxes. In Nicaragua, there's two operating miners, Mako Mining and Caliber Mining, that are doing great. They're generating taxes, and the government's permitting them quickly. They're getting their projects going quickly. In contrast, Guatemala seems to block all their projects. Pan America's Escobal has been sitting dormant for the last 5 to 6 years with no action. Bluestone's having a hard time getting their project permitted and up and running. And we just saw a few issues at one of our sponsor companies, Volcanic Gold, on their early stage drilling. So wouldn't you think more countries would look at what Nicaragua's doing or some of the successful countries and say, we want this tax money coming in. We want the jobs. We want the foreign investment. And the companies are happy to pay the taxes to pay to play. Wouldn't you think more countries would take that model on of supporting the mining industry to bring in taxes?
Well, you know, if the companies are paying taxes already, it's much easier for politicians to let them continue to produce. But if they're going to start giving taxes 4 years from now or 3 years from now, a lot of politicians are not interested because they would be helping the next group of politicians, the politicians that come from the next election cycle to benefit from those taxes. So they have no interest in necessarily permitting companies that will come in the next cycle of elections. So my guess is that, you know, and I'm not a big fan of Nicaragua or Guatemala anyway, but if you are producing good taxes and if you continue to have a good relationship with politicians, then you continue to stay unharmed as long as you continue paying your taxes.
Giant, where do you get your news that you use to judge just how healthy or, quite frankly, investable a country is? Because you don't want to listen, I don't think, to management, because management, whatever country they're in, they're going to put a positive spin on it. And I think a lot of newsletter writers, they're extremely biased too, because they want to be part of a bigger movement. They want to tie into one country and really usually hang their hat on that country, hopefully performing. So I find them also biased. What do you do to filter through all this noise and figure out where actually could be investable?
Well, so again, going back to this Colombian company that I was mentioning, which I don't want to name, they are a company that's producing a good profit for me, and they have a lot of cash in the bank, and they have projects elsewhere as well. And if I ignore completely the value of their Colombian project, I still get an upside in owning that company. And the project that is making money for me is a significantly good amount of money that pretty much justifies the company's valuation by itself. So that is how I look at things. I want to see what is the worst case scenarios with these companies. What happens if I completely lose a certain project? What happens if one thing that I'm most afraid of goes out of existence? Would I still have enough value underpinning my share price? And if I have that, then I'm more than happy to invest in such companies. And if I have an upside with what I'm reasonably confident about, then I am less fearful about investing in them. Now, what happens with the market is that a lot of people start selling their shares without trying to understand that they don't do a valuation on what. They look at one aspect of these companies and start selling their shares. And that is where I actually benefit from accumulating those companies and hope that I can make money over the next 6 months or couple of years.
John, I think that's a great point, because while we're focused on jurisdictions in this interview, there's still the team, the project, the ability to execute. There's a lot of things that factor into evaluation, not just the jurisdiction. But I guess just one last thing to maybe touch on is, how important is it for you that when you bring in an expat country, like you have Canadians or Americans or British or Australians working in some of these more exotic, you know, locations, how important is it for them to have the local teams in place that have the political understanding and the support of the communities versus coming in and trying to put their own people in? How do you weigh that at all when you're looking at investing in companies, the spread of their local workers and management versus international?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's extremely crucial. If someone from Canada goes to a new country without really understanding that country properly and thinks that it can make money investing in that company, it isn't going to happen. I want people who are well-versed in the local culture and local politics, people who understand and have relationships with local leaders, local native leaders and local politicians. Now, that is not always an honest relationship, but that's something you have to have if you are investing in these countries. And I'm always looking for how good the management that I'm investing in is at implementing projects in those countries.
So, Giant, wrap us up then. Quick comment in terms of what are you doing with your portfolio? As I mentioned, the onset of the first segment when we started recording here, look, the resource stocks have been crushed. Big guys and little guys, especially the little guys and the mid-tiers. Everyone keeps trying to look for a bottom, and unfortunately, where they're looking just keeps getting a little bit lower. What are you doing? Are you investing right now? Are you sitting on cash? Are you rotating money? Just give us some insights, please.
Well, over the last time when I talked with you, I told you that I did not see gold to fall anymore. I did not think venture exchange would fall anymore. And it has, of course, fallen a lot over the last 1 month. What I have done over the last few weeks is that I have sold a lot of companies that I did not think had enough upside and other bad companies, and I have accumulated all that cash, and I'm investing in companies that I think have good upsides. So that's what I'm currently doing. I'm rotating my money, but I'm almost 100% invested at this point of time.
All right, Giant, thank you for your time on this weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show. As always, you can keep in touch with Shad and I through email. My email is fleck@kereport.com. Shad's is shad@kereport.com. We're going to be back with you early next week, covering a lot of resources, some more macro stuff, and who knows, hopefully a more positive vibe, as this early on in summer has already been really tough for investors, especially the investors in the resource sector, as it has just continued to trend lower. But hey, there are some, I guess, good companies and some good deals for some of these stocks. But again, just been a tough year so far broadly for these markets. Everybody, thanks again for tuning in. Hope you all have a great rest of your week.